Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is March 27th, and we have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, The Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, Will You Be Richer or Poorer? Global Crisis, National Renewal, a Revolutionary Grand Strategy for the United States. His blog of twominds.com was one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites, and now he has a special focus on his own Substack. Welcome, Charles.
Well, thank you, Richard. I'm looking forward to our discussion today on very big topics that are of concern, I think, to everyone.
Yeah, and specifically, let's do a discussion on the potential for a global recession that's deeper and longer than most analysts expect. Your initial thoughts?
Yeah, Richard, I think a lot of people are focusing on the potential for a recession in the U.S., and there's a lot of evidence that this is a definite possibility. You know, a consumer has tapped out, and there's trade war reverberations and so on. And I think the context here is that all the major economies of the world are linked. And so if there's a recession in one, there's a kind of a domino effect, especially if part of those forces are write-offs of debt or the decline of currencies or trade wars. You know, all these kind of issues have an impact, not just on the domestic economy of a country, but on other countries. And so there's a lot of weakness and extremes in the global economy that need to be rebalanced, if you will. And so then that rebalancing, typically, if history is a guide, is rather painful, right? And that rebalancing is what we call a recession. Like bad debts are written off, investments have to be made that don't have a payoff for many years. The economy has to go through a painful transition, and so that's kind of what we're talking about. Is that transition could be longer and more difficult than many people presume, and so we're kind of looking at the sources of the problems and also the dynamics that are in play globally.
Yeah, the sources, and I think a lot of it stems from the over-indebtedness of the world. A lot of people point fingers to the U.S., but it's a global unsustainable debt, both at government level and at the private level. Just massive, especially since the great financial crisis, you know, which was triggered by lots of debt. It's gone up even higher, maybe a factor of three times higher in debt now than we were at that time. And it's just becoming so overwhelming that the servicing of that debt is now becoming an issue in terms of the interest that's required to service the debt. And so then all of this is now translating to is becoming into geopolitical risks, global political uncertainties. We've done some podcasts also with Michael Every. He's got a good focus on geopolitical risk. He sees a trend towards economic statecraft, where sort of each country is vying for itself with a number of tools, policies, controls, everything from capital controls to tariffs and sanctions and just different types of controls that is designed to manage where capital is also placed and invested. and the flows between countries. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think Michael Every's discussion of statecraft replacing economic efficiencies or profit as the sole driver of how globalization works, I think is really core. And of course, as you say, the driver behind all that is how to manage the debt, either to write it down with inflation or tighten up on spending. Everything is going to be painful. And that has global impacts. I just want to mention, you're bringing up Every's.
Point that out. Yeah, so he's come up with this. He's with Rabobank in Singapore. And this can be downloaded from a number of sites publicly available. We'll put the link underneath the YouTube as well. He goes through, as you mentioned, Charles, there's a number of these trade, capital, and other types of controls, policies, and everything from export controls, boycotts, subsidies, tariffs, capital controls, primary sanctions, secondary sanctions, what we're seeing that happening now in different elements of monetary policy, fiscal policy. So he's got this view, and he divides it like normally, you know, when everything is good, the last several decades, you know, you're just looking at economic policy, making things more efficient. But now it's more like statecraft. How can the state craft its economy through controls and policies? Your thoughts on this, Charles?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent context to understand the next decade, is that the replacement of mostly economic values for the national security and the national economy issues. And so I want to mention in that context, let's discuss the United States, which has been like the global superpower, now competing with China and other nodes of power. And in the Cold War era, the United States, I think, unstated policy was to allow itself to be the dumping ground for excess production of its allies. And so this is what led to the idea of running large trade deficits as standard policy. And of course, that allowed U.S. companies to profit from that, but it also hurt the domestic economy by, you know, offshoring industrial production and so on. So it from one point of view, the U.S. is jettisoning that whole framework, you know, and it's now, in some people's view, it's becoming a rogue superpower. In other words, it's now redefining its interests less from supporting a global, what you might call financial framework, to focusing on its own national interests. And this is now, you know, kind of, in many people's view, maybe throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But I think we can also look at, say, China, the rising superpower, and it is also acting, you know, in terms of statecraft, like it's seeking its place in the sun as it sees. And so all of these, all this jockeying for power or global influence is normal, right? I mean, that's the nature of human civilizations. But it's going to have a lot of impacts that I think are difficult to predict. And I think that's my concern about a global recession, because I don't think the trade wars are over. I think they're barely getting started. And that I see the potential for major powers to be exiting the World Trade Organization and just saying, no, we're not going to follow any rules, and or basically acting as if there are no rules. And so then that framework of global trade will then become more stressed and possibly break down. And then that could lead to shortages or soaring prices and the kind of things we're already seeing. Another quick topic I want to discuss and ask you to speak to is, there was an article in the Foreign Affairs magazine last month about the strange divide in the United States between its domestic dysfunction, both its political and social and economic dysfunctions, where a lot of people feel like their quality of life and their standard of living has been declining. And there's a lot of political angst about that. But then the United States still has a claim on this sort of global influence. And I think you could make the same argument about China, that the popping of the real estate bubble has really hurt their domestic household wealth and sense of security. But meanwhile, China's rising. Its global power is on the rise. So we see that I think every major trading power has a disconnect. Its domestic economy and society may be suffering even as its global power is maintained or it's rising. So yeah, let me speak to this chart that you have.
Yeah, this is a chart from Louis Vincent Gave of Gave Call. He's used this chart in a number of recent podcasts, and he actually likes this one chart the best in terms of what, if you had to take home one snippet of information and insight. And there's a lot going on here, but what happened in 2018 is, or was the transition for China to go into economic statecraft. So in 2018, there was imposition of some sanctions on technology, semiconductor chips by the U.S. on China. And so they said, look, we need to diversify and start, you know, getting our industry in order and enhanced. So at that time, there was a shift by the banks, encouraged by the government, for instead of providing loans to property, real estate property development, let's provide that or focus it more on industrial development. And so what happened since 2018, as you can see in the chart, the industrial sector has just gone through the roof, where China has essentially leapfrogged the U.S. in so many areas, so many sectors, not the least of which is the automobile sector, like with the BYD car, the plug-in hybrid that can go 2,100 kilometers without a fill of gas or a charge, at perhaps 4 to 7 times cheaper cost than or a cheaper price than a Tesla, right? Tesla being 7 times more expensive, roughly, more or less. And you have to charge it maybe every third of that 2100, you know, range. So that's just one example. But we've heard of the AI as well. Now they've got new ways of doing AI that is much cheaper, less costly, less involved with infrastructure, and more with software. You know, with the DeepSeek now up to version 3. In other types of AI technologies that will enhance the capability to do AI applications significantly, so across the board. So yeah, it's just amazing what's happened in the industrial sector in China. But as you mentioned, it's a dichotomy as well, because many people have suffered during this time period with the collapse of the real estate sector, because a lot of people put a good amount of their savings in real estate property, and now it has come down significantly. Same thing in the U.S. We have similar, although a little bit different dynamics, but you've got a dichotomy as well. Did you want to elaborate on that? And you've provided some charts too that we could take a look at.
No, I'm using the charts from the U.S. and this is, but I believe that these issues, which I'm going to enumerate, are really global. And say, for instance, the enormous rise in debt to fund the economy, which Richard already spoke to. I think this is a global problem. It's not U.S., but this chart is U.S. centric, but I think it speaks to a global problem. And then in terms of housing affordability and wealth inequality, I think we see this around the world, that the bottom, say, 80%, and certainly the bottom 50% in many economies, that population is not feeling like their standard of living is improving. They feel that their standard of living and the quality of their life has actually declined, even as the economy has boomed or continued growing. So yeah, here's housing affordability. And of course, this is a US chart, but housing's unaffordable in the core cities of China. It's unaffordable in Europe. It's unaffordable in Canada. It's unaffordable in a lot of places. So we're talking about these issues that cross national borders. And so here's another one that is also a global reality, which is the boomer generation, which benefited from the globalization and financialization of the last, say, 40 years. They hold the majority of the household wealth in stocks, bonds, real estate, and enterprises. Yeah, this is a chart of the U.S., but I believe that this would apply to many other nations, that there's a generational inequity or divide, that the younger generations don't have the same wealth that their parents have. And the other divide here that this chart shows is just the wealth and income divide has increased dramatically from around the late 90s or early 2000s, around the dot-com era and when China entered the WTO. So that is a trend. It's also global. The wealthy have gotten wealthier and the bottom 50% have seen their share stagnate of the economy. So the benefits of globalization and financialization have been concentrated in the top, say, 5%, 10% globally. So these are issues that are really difficult to address. And so in a way, we can say that we have these conflicts like trade wars, but underneath that, all the nations, most of the nations of the world are facing very similar problems. And one last one is, of course, public health, that the Western diet, heavy on fat, salt, sugar, and other issues have spread around the world. And so there's a metabolic disorder is now a global problem. And so in many countries, half of the population is at risk of these lifestyle diseases. And here in the United States, only like 27% of the people have a normal weight. Almost three-fourths of the population is overweight or obese and therefore at risk of these metabolic lifestyle disorders. And diabetes is on the rise in Mexico, the Mideast, Pakistan, India. I mean, it's a global problem. And this is serious because this takes people away from the workforce, right, as they become disabled from illness. And it also creates a tremendous burden on every national government to try to fund healthcare for these this population. So again, these problems are not financial per se, but they have huge financial impacts. And so that's kind of my point. And so how do you settle? How do you reduce this wealth inequality? How do you improve the health of the public? How do you make housing and food more affordable? I mean, these are not easy problems to solve. And so, we're mixing into that this statecraft where every country is trying to jockey for whatever's going to improve its economy, perhaps at the expense of its trading partners.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yes, and if you can speak also to some of the other factors that you're seeing that will make the recession prolonged and deeper. Your thoughts on that? One thing I would say is the idea that historically it's been an inflating away of the debt, you know, on the financial problems. As you mentioned, it's not just financial, but a large part of this has been initially triggered as a catalyst from the excessive debt, which would likely play out with a withering away of that debt through the inflating away of the debt via inflation and depreciation and or devaluation of the currency at the same time. So with lower economic activity as sort of stagflationary long-term trend, like over a 5 to 10 year period, would eventually reduce the burden of debt. So that's usually how it plays out. But you know, if you could speak, Charles, some of these other factors that you've highlighted.
Right. That's really the fundamental point. Richard, I'm glad you made that fundamentally we're in what some people call a debt super cycle, or this historical cycle that you mentioned, that many people have spoken to, that it's easy to expand credit, but it's not so easy to reduce that load of interest, right? That's the dragon eating its tail of debt. So then this raises the issue that becomes political, which is which part of your population is going to take the hit, which is who's going to suffer the pain of either as currencies depreciate or the government spending is tightened, somebody's going to suffer some economic discomfort, right? And so who's going to be at the, who's going to get targeted and who's going to be saved, or that the pain is going to be diverted away from the, a certain population and fall on someone else. Because obviously, if the currencies are devaluing, everybody's getting poorer, right? You can add a zero to your money; it doesn't make you doesn't make you rich, because that purchasing power is declining anyway. So that becomes a political issue, and every government is going to have to deal with that. And if they make if they push all the pain onto one sector of their population, that raises the potential for like social disorder or the overthrow of the regime, because people can only take so much, and then they start realizing that we should change the regime as being less painful than continuing to just see their lifestyle stagnate. So those political choices are going to play out globally as well. Another issue that I think we need to speak to is between China and the U.S. is one issue, but the global South and many of the countries that are providing commodities, such as the oil exporters, we see this potential for chokeholds or dependencies that will give exporters great power. In other words, we can look at fresh water, energy, and food, you know, what I call the few resources, you know, food, energy, water. And if the countries that don't have enough domestic sources for those things, they're really dependent on their trading partners. And so that gives those trading partners a lot of power. And so I think there's a lot of potential there, whether planned or unplanned, for things like food riots as food scarcities occur, or, you know, warfare over, you know, fresh water in terms of rights to rivers that are shared by various nations, and energy, of course, the general consensus is there's enough energy to run the economy, especially if we transition to more natural gas. But it's like there isn't that many countries that have a surplus of natural gas, so they have tremendous power, because all these things like data centers and factories and all of that requires a huge amount of energy. And if you don't have the domestic sources, then you're going to have to, you're dependent. And so those dependencies create conflicts, or they have great potential for conflicts or suffering, right? If food shortages occur or energy's tight and, you know, the power goes out, you know, except for a few hours here and there, then there's a lot of suffering of just the normal people as the result. So again, these are problems that aren't unique to one country or one trading bloc.
And those countries that have few resources could face societal collapse, I think you pointed out.
Yeah, that's right. And so, and then conflicts will arise because if you're pushed to desperation, then you take desperate measures. So, you've done a lot of work, Richard, on capital flows into from the developed world, the G7, to the global south. And I think that's a really important point that we want to make here, is that deglobalization and trade wars is not like a universal one dynamic. It's actually a mix of a variety of dynamics. And so your map here speaks to that there's capital is flowing to countries that may be undercapitalized. And so this would be a positive rebalancing, that this concentration of capital in the U.S. and Europe and can benefit the global economy by flowing into nations that have potential for growth that are undercapitalized.
Yeah, this is a very interesting diagram. It actually comes from Armstrong Economics on the Socrates platform. You can go to the link here on our Substack. We recently wrote about this. So this is actually a projected international capital flows on a monthly basis. So in the coming months, near months here coming. And so you can see the green ones is where capital is flowing into, which is interesting because given potential escalating wars in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, you would think capital would come to the U.S. as it has historically. But this is showing up as a yellow here, which indicates either a top or a bottom. So maybe it's indicating more of the capital flows from the concentration risk in the U.S. equity markets, right? With 18% of all investable capital in the world in the Mag 7 equities in the U.S. markets now perhaps topping out in. And that flow is going international to other markets. So that could be an indication here. Also, Argentina is quite interesting, very green, as President Milei reforms the country there. And as you pointed out, a lot of the resource-rich countries, Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia, Brazil, showing up as green as well.
Yeah, and let's speak to the idea that we've spoken about in the past, Richard, about relocalization within various nations. Then, where's the capital going? And as you pointed out, trillions of dollars of capital have flowed to a handful of giant global corporations. And so, the question that arises is, well, if that money is going to be bleeding out of that, because that's just a distorted extreme, right? That concentration of capital is not sustainable and probably not healthy. Where would it go in the developed economies? And of course, one answer is it can go into the relocalizing the economy, as opposed to just passive investing in giant global corporations. And that would benefit local communities that have been left behind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's going to happen with the trend of economic statecraft. If you think of the enticement or encouragement of deploying capital, maybe not necessarily as international as before, but with a more significant and rising local component. So this would help, like in countries doing the like reindustrialization, reshoring, manufacturing renaissance, such as the U.S. is looking to do. This would make sense in that regard.
Yeah, and you've done a lot of work in terms of looking at opportunities in the global south, and I think the idea here that I would want to emphasize is the potential of the kinds of things you're doing actually benefit the local economy in the Global South nations, as opposed to the sort of exploitative model that's sort of what I call neo-colonial, where a giant, you know, Western corporation or, you know, giant global corporation goes in and sort of exploits the land or bulldozes it and it, or builds a resort or something that doesn't necessarily benefit the local community. And it's, I think we want to speak to the potential to do the kind of investing that could generate a good return, but it's actually benefiting the local population as opposed to exploiting cheap labor and their resources.
Yeah, absolutely. And along with that, the idea of fostering an educational environment that can help bring about this development. You know, there's been a lot of people that have come to the U.S. and now have spread out into different countries internationally. So that is a good thing for helping out other countries, other local areas. They'll get the benefit of that educational resource. And then within the U.S. too, it's going to be very important to do an education, an emphasis on education in areas like the manufacturing sector and engineering to help foster the whole manufacturing renaissance and to bring about competitive industries, you know, especially being able to compete with China's ascent in the world. They graduate more engineers in China than that there are engineers in the U.S. And they do that on a yearly basis. So it's pretty massive in China, the emphasis on engineering studies. So that's going to be critical, and that may take time. So it's not going to happen overnight. That's going to be the challenge for especially the U.S. with a focus on that. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, absolutely, Richard. We're talking again about this idea of recalibrating or rebalancing economies that are out of sync with the change or have extreme distortions. And so to take your example of reindustrializing the U.S., well, we have a labor shortage of skilled labor. And maybe the capital is flowed into these big mega corporations instead of into small factories that are part of the global supply chain. So I just want to say too that in engineering we can also add craft skills that kind of like the U.S. has fallen behind or faltered in its trade schools. The idea that you can make a good living and a reliable, secure living, learning skills relating to manufacturing, and as opposed to just, a lot of people seem to be focusing on things like trading cryptos or, you know, part of the financialization boom, and that's really not that productive, especially in terms of national security or statecraft, right? I mean, you've got to have, as you say, an educated workforce. And that includes not just high-end engineers, but just people that can work with CAD/CAM systems and welders. And I mean, the work requires people actually doing the work. You know, not everything can be done by a robot. That's a big potential in terms of investing and also personal choices. Like, before we started recording, we started talking about, well, what does this mean for each individual and household? And of course, it means that, if you want to have a secure livelihood and a good quality of life, you need to consider, like, where's your place in this rapidly changing world? And so acquiring skill sets that are going to become more valuable, getting into these fields like we're talking about that are reindustrialization or localizing. Those are all places that you can change your life to fit what's coming down the road, as opposed to trying to cling on to some sector that's in decline or is losing government funding or, whatever, right? And we also spoke to the idea that, we looked at things like health. The individual health is a huge impact on your quality of life. And if we think that, well, maybe the government isn't going to save us, you know, maybe the government can't save us. Maybe we're going to have to change our lifestyle ourselves in order to get healthy and have a productive life. We're going to have to do the heavy lifting ourselves. And that sort of resilience and self-reliance is, you know, what I preach. Like, don't wait for the government to solve these problems. We're asking a lot of the government to just try to solve these huge problems like the debt load. And so we're going to have to solve a lot of these problems ourselves by, you know, changing our lives for the better. And I think that's a positive way to look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've written a lot on that in your many books in terms of self-reliance or what skills can I acquire to be more independent and survive in like a gig economy, all kinds of ideas you present in your books. But yeah, the idea that used to be in the old days that people would ask, how can we solve this problem, right, at a private level? Now it's more like, what is the government doing to solve that problem, right? It's, you know, which generally in many cases makes it worse because they're not as efficient as the private sector in providing the solutions, not as adaptable, not as quick, not as fast. And look at the success now of Argentina in looking to make the government very small, very efficient, but very small, and then opening up all the opportunities for innovation, for entrepreneurialism. So this is the basis of some of the principles of the Austrian school of economics that we strongly follow. Smaller government, but fostering an environment of more innovation, entrepreneurialism, creating jobs, creating new industries, less of the regulatory capture that we've talked about in other podcasts. Your thoughts?
Right. And I would add the Mexican government's attempts, the new president of Mexico's attempts to not force people, but to foster a return to traditional foods and diets that are much healthier, and then create more, you know, economic opportunity instead of buying stuff that's ultra processed, made by global corporations, that we return to, you know, growing more food locally and healthier food. So this is a good example in my mind to what the government can do, which is sort of point the way and foster a healthier quality of life, but without mandates and, you know, agencies with 100,000 people. So in other words, the government has a lot of power just to, without mandating things, it can just simply encourage people to improve the quality of life and support their efforts, as opposed to hindering them, as you say, with overregulation or supporting global corporations at the expense of the local populations.
Yeah, and sometimes you can solve many problems together. So we also wrote this article on the Substack of how to your point about human health. You know, everybody is always talking about carbon emissions challenge. So how can you solve the world's carbon emissions challenge and enhance human health at the same time? So this article goes through that, and it's basically through regenerative agriculture. If you make the soil about 5 to 10% more sustainable, you know, in terms of soil microorganisms, you not only create that sink, that sequestration of carbon emissions, of all carbon emissions from all human activity and all industrial activity globally, that is produced on a yearly basis, would be taken in by the soil. Plus, at the same time, you get the benefit of a healthier soil, giving rise to enhancement of human health at the same time.
Yeah, that's a terrific example, Richard. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I read that and I was really inspired by that. And there's a lot of similar ideas of the circular economy where industrial waste is reused. And so these are examples of opportunities that are not based on some new technology. It's simply investing in techniques that are smarter and more beneficial. They're not exploitive. They're actually regenerative. And there are a lot of such ideas. So those aren't as easy as just buying an S&P 500 passive fund, right? I mean, it's going to take more work, but the work will be rewarded, I think, not just in terms of a return, financially return, but also being part of this rebalancing of the global economy. You know, doing good and doing well at the same time is possible.
Yeah, that's great positive ideas. We like to end our podcast with on those positive notes for suggestions for improvement.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Richard. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, it was a great, insightful discussion. Thank you so much, Charles.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.